Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do we really need school to educate ourselves? And is it the best we can do for our children? John Taylor Gatto taught for nearly 30 years in public schools, some of the best and some of the worst. And in that time, he became a self-proclaimed expert in boredom on the part not only of the students, but of their teachers as well. Upon quitting in 1991, the same year he had been named New York State's Teacher of the Year, Gatto wrote a scathing Wall Street Journal op-ed that laid out his greatest objections to the way American children are educated. Today, he is convinced that while everybody requires an education, school systems, as we know them, may ultimately do more harm than good. His latest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be with you.
I'll begin by asking you to define the difference between schooling and education.
Okay, well, briefly speaking, schooling is imposed from without. It's a given, although you don't have much choice about receiving it. And education is taken by the individual from a mix of different influences. I call the best educations open source because they draw on whatever texts work for the particular individual. Education is always customized, and schooling is always standardized.
And I guess, you know, some people will argue that, you know, there's the famous quote from Winston Churchill where he said, democracy is the very worst system of government except for all the others that have been tried. And people will make a similar argument sort of about the way that we educate people.
Well, it's ironic that you brought Churchill up because there's a famous letter he wrote to his Minister of Education where he said schooling and education are much different things, and of necessity we want as little as possible of education in our schools. There's a reason to standardize people that's very practical. It may not be moral, but it's very practical. A mass production economy has a difficulty if it can't predict what the mass of people are going to do, what color ladies are going to wear in the fall. Their fortunes ride on these gambles every year, and the easiest way to guess correctly is to rig the game in advance by standardizing the population. And that, in fact, was an idea we borrowed from Prussian Germany about 100 years ago. It seemed to make perfect sense since we were converting from an economy of independent livelihoods to one of great corporations. So rather than make your own way in the world, the idea was you'd get a good job if you had standardized yourself correctly.
So we're essentially giving everyone similar values in addition to sort of teaching them the three R's or the R's.
In the inner sanctum of the business, right back to the beginning, and I'm not talking about Plato, I'm talking about, let's say Harvard University 100 years ago, it was very, very clear what schools were intended to produce. They had functions that were enumerated, none of which had anything to do with learning reading, writing, and arithmetic. A very, very famous Harvard professor for whom the honor lecture in education at Harvard is named, Alexander Ingalls, although it looks like it's English, it's pronounced Ingalls. Ingalls in 1917 set down publicly the six purposes of forced schooling, and it's very important that we emphasize the adjective, Chris, forced. Why does it have to be forced if it's so good for people? He said the very first reason to have these schools is to make all children as alike as possible so their behavior could become predictable and their choices and allegiances could be manipulated by the managers of the economy. And he followed in that vein with five other purposes of schooling to establish fixed habits of subordination to authority so you'd respond reflexively when given an order. Notice the amusing part of that. You can't test whether somebody has fixed habits of subordination unless you ask them to do stupid things and they obey. Then you know you've succeeded in that purpose. Then people were to be selected in childhood for later rewards, and their superiority or inferiority was to be logged mathematically on cumulative records. One of the darkest purpose that these folks were very proud of announcing was that this would assist Darwin's natural selection, because you'd tag the inferior people with disgrace through bad grades or punishments of some sort, remedial placements. And that way, the good breeding stock would know to stay away from those people. And finally, a small group of students were to be trained through the years to take over this system and perpetuate it. We're not talking about conspiracy here, Chris, but we certainly aren't talking about either any sort of public vote on whether this is what schools should do or not. This is the guy the honor lecturer in education at Harvard is named after. And, of course, there's tons of other evidence of what's going on. Standardized tests, for example, don't measure anything at all except that you've memorized what you were told to memorize. In your life, in my life, and in anybody's life listening, we never ask after the information on grade point averages or standardized tests, because we know on some level of sanity that the information's worthless. We test our friends and the people we hire the same way we ought to be testing school kids, by watching performance. You know, you prove you can speak well by speaking well, not by passing a paper pencil test on speaking. This is so skewed from the normal way that we evaluate in the world that I think we have a collective blindness. We've put it out of possible judgment.
Is that, do you think, a consequence of the necessity for some kind of economy of scale when you have, you know, millions of school-age children that have to be taught certain things? Are there other ways to take that number of children and at least teach them the basic skills they need to function?
Well, there's an enormous assumption in your question, which is a question I certainly have heard frequently over the years. So we have about 3 million homeschoolers in the country right now who are, on test measures, always superior to the public school kids there. The assumption that we need some form of collective discipline is one that I would question, and I'll give you some very, very famous names that are in everybody's book of success. If you look at the people who created the computer industry, Bill Gates, his partner Paul Allen, Steve Jobs, his partner Steve Wozniak, Michael Dell, Larry Ellison of Oracle, I could go on, they're all dropouts. How did that happen? Is it some peculiar trillion-to-one chance? How about the only worldwide television network, CNN, being founded by a dropout? How'd that happen? On April the 13th of last year, 60 Minutes said, they got Rick Smalley, who won a Nobel Prize, and as a cancer researcher, to say the most important cancer development that had ever taken place had occurred in the hands of somebody with no science background and no college degree, a fellow named John Canisius, who invented a way to destroy tumors with radio waves rather than the more familiar damaging radiation. He shoots the tumor full of metal particles and runs radio waves through them. There's no side effects, no after effects, and the tumor's destroyed. I could really go on for quite a long time, and maybe really your listeners would benefit from hearing about some of these people. My own uncle, Bud Zimmer, came back from the Second World War, having gone to the war as a steel worker. He got a battlefield promotion to captain at the Battle of the Bulge, and one of the men in his unit was a fellow named Al Rockwell, the heir to the Rockwell manufacturing fortune. So Bud comes back, probably intending to be a steel worker again. He gets a call from Al Rockwell, and Rockwell says, "I want you to come out and manage my manufacturing plant in Belle Fountain, Ohio. You know, we have 5,000 employees in our own railroad siding." And Bud wasn't shy in any way, but he sort of laughed. And Rockwell said, "Oh, don't worry about that." He said, "We got 50 Harvard flunkies. They'll do anything you ask, including lick your boots if you ask them." And he said, "They'll do the work. I need somebody who understands how to manage human beings." Now, that's a personal story, but we have, oh, good grief, a neighbor of mine, on February the 28th of last year, 2008, his name's Nick Shulman. He's 21. He dropped out of junior high school at age 13 to play pool. Imagine how his mother felt. Then at 18, he took up computer games, and shortly afterwards, poker. 3 years later, he won $2 million on the World Poker Tour, and he was headlines in the New York newspapers. Richard Branson, who's, I think, the world's 20th wealthiest man, was photographed on the front page of the New York Times last year standing next to a spaceship he had just completed and sold every seat in it for $200,000, or 250 seats. Branson attributes his entire success to something that happened to him at the age of 4. His mother drove him miles from home, asked him if he could find his way home in London, mind you, all by himself. He said yes. She said, "Well, get out and do so," and she drove home. It was a single-parent family. He said when he got home 8 or 10 hours later, he said nothing ever frightened him again in his life. He dropped out of high school later, never went to college, had his first successful business at age 19. We've pulled a piece of German wool over our population's eyes for about 100 years now, and I don't think we can afford it any longer.
John Taylor Gatto is my guest. He is a former teacher and a school reform advocate. His newest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is school reform advocate John Taylor Gatto. His newest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. John, I want to ask you, and this is, I know, an argument that you've also heard in the past, is it possible that the people you mentioned before the break, Steve Jobs and Richard Branson and Bill Gates, is it possible that they are so exceptional that they can't be fairly compared to the rest of society that relies on traditional education?
It's certainly a fair question, Chris, and yes, I hear it all the time. I think what makes me a little bit different than most people who speak out on school matters is that I taught in Manhattan in a junior high school for 30 years, and for 15 of those years, I ran a program called the Lab School that mixed together indiscriminately the best students with the worst students, with holdovers. And we had a community-based curriculum that was highly, intensely academic. And what I witnessed during those 15 years was that very, very ordinary people can do extraordinary things. I'm looking right now at our class newspaper, a picture of a 13-year-old boy under the headline, Pizza Palace Sued, this 13-year-old kid from Harlem, a C student, back in 1980, launched a lawsuit against the pizza parlor for discrimination, won the lawsuit, and today he's quite a successful lawyer, even though at the time he engaged the pizza parlor, he was a C student. He got an all-tuition-paid scholarship to a fancy law school. And over, it's not just one. That's one I happen to be looking at. I had a huge amount of experience asking, quote, average kids to do extraordinary things, and I would say in the large majority of cases, they did that. Chris, we have 7,000 new dropouts every school day in America. Are those kids any different in promise to these elementary school dropouts? Thomas Edison, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, or this junior high school dropout, George Bernard Shaw. These are all people from very ordinary families. In Edison's case, a single mom family. In Carnegie's case, two immigrant Scots who'd never worked outside of the garment industry in their life. And John D. Rockefeller's family were snake oil salesmen, literally snake oil salesmen.
I wonder if you can talk about, because you did do some very extraordinary things when you were teaching, how difficult was it to break as an educator out of the mold that was set up for you by existing school systems?
Well, it was extremely difficult because my horizon had been conditioned into me by schooling. I think the one advantage I might have had was because of an illness in the family, I was sent far from home to Jesuit private boarding school in third grade. That was the middle of the Second World War. And in third grade, we had algebra. We were taught to think dialectically. Half the time, it seems, we spoke in Latin, and nobody had any particular problem with that. You know, so it intrigued me enough to begin to study the template, the pattern of schooling back in colonial America and in the early federal days. And the Tocqueville's Democracy in America is a wonderful guide to this. He looks at this country full of ignorant people and irreverent working class people, and he says it's the best educated country in the history of the world, including classical Greece. He said the key is that all of them read like college professors. He didn't use the word college professors, but they read extremely well. In like one of the purposes of institutionalizing schooling was to control somewhat how well people learned how to read. I know that sounds creepy, but I don't mean it to. North Germany was the pattern of success in schooling all over the world, as far away as Japan. And the Germans schooled their kids to be manageable, and that made the leadership in military affairs and in economic matters very efficient because people did what they were told to do. But we followed an entirely different course. And one evidence is that by the advent of World War II, this country got more patents than all the rest of the countries in the world combined by a factor of 9. I mean, this is really rubbing it in, isn't it? We had about 90% of all the patents on planet Earth after World War II, when the Germanic schooling is made much more efficient. Our patents start to drop. Today, we have about 29% of the patents, and that number drops yearly. What we've done is wipe out the imagination, the inventiveness, and the self-reliance. And I mean that exactly as it sounded, not as an extreme statement. If you look at the philosophers of schooling, there's not a single one of them who doesn't ask the leadership to remove the imagination, because it's a wild card. And once you have an imaginative population, they're capable of surprising the people who accumulate capital and set up big corporate enterprises. So we can't have that if we're going to have a corporate economy. The imagination has to go. And we've known through history how to destroy the human imagination. It's by regulating time, making it bell-driven and class-driven and test-driven. You don't have to do that very long before what you have are little nervous wrecks or little ambitious point scorers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is John Taylor Gatto, the school reform advocate. His latest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. Let's speak first with Jeff in Dallas. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, what a great topic. I've got a specific kind of a situation that I find myself in. I have two girls, one of which is 9, the other one is about to turn 6. We decided when they were young enough to start preschool that we were going to send them to Montessori school, where they have been since they were that old. When my 9-year-old was old enough to graduate from her first Montessori school in 3rd grade, we looked at some other schools, but primarily we were looking at the idea of transferring her into a public institution here in Dallas. And so as a result, she ended up taking the tax test and did absolutely disastrously on it. And it just, you know, shocked us to no end. And so, you know, the whole reason that we put our kids in Montessori was because we abhor the idea of standardization of in any stretch of the, you know, imagination. And we realized that through Montessori that we have a very industrious child, a very imaginative child, a child who is self-directed, loves the idea of learning, but just doesn't fit into the quote-unquote mold of public school, evidently. But my dilemma is this, is that the school that we currently have her in, and let me add, by the way, that by making the decision to put her into yet another Montessori school, we had to go through bells and whistles to try and find one that we, you know, could get to in time with our schedules. But more importantly, we're spending enormous amounts of money in order to make this happen. But to get back to what our fear is that this school only goes to 8th grade. So ultimately, we're going to be faced with the same situation again when she enters 9th grade. And it just terrifies us because it seems like, inevitably, our kid is going to be forced into the quote-unquote system, which will ultimately do what your guest is talking about in terms of her imagination and her industriousness. And I wonder if the guest might have some insight into either what I can do or if I can do anything.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, John?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I run into people with this exact dilemma all over the country, indeed all over the world, where I lecture. If she's going to inevitably return to this standardized environment, it's not very difficult to have her return with the eyes of an anthropologist, so that although she seems to be a part of the daily routines, she's actually watching very closely who, when, what, where, and why. She's testing certain theories without anyone knowing that she's doing that. She's using the school as a textbook rather than the academic directions of the school as the nourishment for her mind. But there are other things you can do as well. Certainly, though, to send your kid to a public school as an anthropologist is to give the mind amazing insights to work on. That needs to be concealed, obviously, what you're doing. The second thing is that if you clearly understand what standardized schools do wrong, and it is very hard to do, that they teach you to consume knowledge from other people rather than to produce new knowledge yourself. They teach you to disconnect yourself from every other source of authority and information than the ones they assign you. If they give you idea-thin, watered-down curriculum, to reverse those three things isn't very difficult to do. If you set out to produce new knowledge, let me give you a sample of that because it sounds too abstract. A 13-year-old girl about 4 months ago in Manhattan made the front pages of the press here by doing something that anyone could do and probably is worth doing in Dallas. She had read that the stalks of a very desirable fish, red snapper, and I know it's desirable in Dallas too because my son's down there, that the stalks were dwindling catastrophically, but the amount of red snapper for sale was abundant in all the good markets and fish stores, and it provoked some suspicion in her mind. So she gathered 42 tissue samples, sent it to a DNA laboratory. They reported back that 80% of the fish sold as red snapper is redfish, a very cheap fish. So she had produced a piece of new knowledge. My kids regularly, year after year, would look at newspaper articles based on surveys, and almost invariably when that happens, the Dallas Morning News will say, based on a survey of 800 people. Well, they would then organize a survey with five times that many interviews, and they would test their results with what the paper said the American public was thinking or doing. And very, very frequently, the skew is enormous. Suddenly you begin to see how polls before elections can be rigged in such a way that a whole lot of people are discouraged from voting at all because it seems one candidate has an overwhelming lead when in fact it's faulty mathematics. Let me say that to be kind. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold. So there are ways to involve your daughters in active learning even while they're embedded. I had an interview with a Harvard admissions officer 2 years ago, and she told me that Harvard barely looks at standardized test scores or grade point averages. She said, we select our students based on a record of distinction, and grades and test scores aren't adequate evidence of distinction. It makes perfect sense to me. So she said, we're looking for what the person has has gathered together on their own to add value to the community around them. That should be an early warning system, whether you want your kid to go to Harvard or not. It's the way we all judge one another.
So assuming that we keep the buildings where they are and we keep enrollment what it is, how do you completely remake the way we do school now into something that you think would actually work to educate children?
Well, there are certainly the ways I mentioned. If school was reoriented, which it can be, I just spoke in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan before a superintendent's panel convened to look for some way to change what their award-winning schools were doing. And they were very enthusiastic about this idea of producing new knowledge, producing value for the community instead of consuming it, with connecting kids with all the resources in the community that will further that kid's particular motivation-driven idea of where they're going to go. It's very easy to make the curriculum idea dense and to get off the silly, sentimental idea that this is going to hurt kids' feelings. Drenching them in childish nonsense, talking choo-choo trains, is what will ruin those kids. Not reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, which I know sounds very arcane and la-di-da, but how about this? Would it be worth something to the ordinary children of Dallas and to the wealthy children of Dallas, both, to know that the richest man in the world and the most powerful man in the world thought late in his life that nothing he could buy and nothing he could order other people to do was worth having? I think that would be a gift to everybody.
John Taylor Gatto is with us. His latest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A Schoolteacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. We'll return to the conversation in a moment. You can email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Education reform advocate John Taylor Gatto is my guest. His latest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A Schoolteacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Mr. Gatto, I just wanted to say that I'm in complete agreement with you. I'm familiar with the material you're talking about in terms of German education. Just wanted to give you a brief thumbnail, kind of going back historically. My comment is that, one, the educational system is extremely hypocritical, and it sets up an environment of discrimination. I don't have a college degree. I'm constantly competing with people with PhDs because of my experience and my background, and lose out many times. I've won a few times, so that's. But it's getting more and more difficult. It's pushing the boulder up the mountain. I dropped out of college twice in the 70s, early 70s, ended up backpacking to India, traveling in the Middle East and throughout the United States, Mexico, and Canada, got married, and we had two daughters that we homeschooled and home-birthed, and both of them were quite adept, decided themselves they wanted to play music. My oldest daughter started playing violin at 4, and my youngest daughter started playing the cello at age 2.5. Over a period of years, we managed to get them teachers at Juilliard. My oldest daughter graduated with a master's degree from NYU in music. My youngest daughter decided to go into architecture this last year. She's 17 now. But my comment is that, we need to somehow confront the educational system for it to be more honest and admit their hypocrisy, to include people that don't have college degrees within the system. You know, they're hypocritical in that they know, as well as you pointed out, Bill Gates, et cetera, you know, all dropped out of college. So they honor these people, and yet in the system, they reject that notion that you don't need an education to succeed because it puts a dent in their economics. So appreciate your work.
Yeah, Stephen, I think that you've raised one of the most important things that obfuscate clear thought in the general public. We tend, and it's perfectly natural, to think of the romantic undertaking of transforming a child into an educated adult. And what we fail to see over and over again is that this is the largest business in the United States of America, by far. It's the largest business on planet Earth. It employs more people. It employs more people in mid-range to upper-middle-class jobs. I mean, in most villages, towns, and small cities, the district superintendent and the principal is well-paid as anyone in the town, and the teachers are considerably better paid than most people in the town. This is the largest grantor of contracts in the United States of America, and we bulk buy textbooks for the state of California, and somebody's instantly made wealthy by those purchases. Chalk, bologna, buses. In the construction industry, the number one profit item is building, modifying, and tearing down schools. If we understood where the opposition to change comes from, it would be much easier to deal with. But it's fought out on some mock ideological grounds, a whole word reading instruction versus whatever the other
phonics. One. Yeah.
Phonics, yes. Yes, all of the public debates that are repeated interminably are just masks over the reality. Kids learn very, very easily, and they learn almost always on a customized basis. If you want to force people not to become facile readers, good readers, then set up a routine to teach them reading. And I guarantee you the bell curve will suddenly magically appear when it wouldn't appear at all. We had a nation that was superbly well-read. How is it possible for someone in 2009 to pick up a copy of Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, a book about 700 pages long, densely written with 200-word sentences, Latinate, running backwards, and referring to all sorts of history and science, and read it in 1820 to the extent that in a country of 20 million people, 5 million people bought the book. Today, you could offer that book to 100 college graduates, and I'd be surprised if 5 of them made any headway through it unless all the tough parts were screened out of it. Hmm. We have been systematically dumbed down. It's been a deliberate procedure, but the danger there is, if you think it was a bunch of evil people doing it, it was a bunch of people with a different outlook on human nature and what a good human society would be like. We traded liberty and autonomy for security and corporate prosperity.
Let's go next to Ruth in Plano. Hello, Ruth.
Hello. Yes, I have a comment about our educational system in general, and I certainly agree with what Mr. Cato is saying. I think that one of the major problems that our system doesn't do is enable children who have difficulty, for example, with dyslexia and succeeding in life. My daughter is 36 years old, and I asked her when she was in seventh grade to help me make a decision that I had no business asking her to make, but I allowed her to drop out of school. And I told her at that time that she would have to work very, very hard in life, and that it wouldn't be easy, and that she would be competing with people who, always in life, who had extensive education. That girl, that little girl, now makes over $140,000 a year. She manages 18 people, and she can do anything, anything. She still doesn't read well. She completed her first book last year. And our system didn't prepare her for an alternative to higher education. It didn't prepare her for working. And I don't think our system prepares anybody for working.
John, would you? I guess you would agree with
that. You know, I not only would agree with you, but in the present distress that we find ourselves in from coast to coast and the increasingly occluded future, I mean, we can't see in our crystal balls any clear way out of this. To waste 7,000 people per day dropping out and then they're marginalized is absolutely madness. It's a form of national suicide. The reason I mentioned Thomas Edison is that he was told, his mother was told, when Edison was simply 7 or 8 years old, that his brain was damaged and he had no future in school or anywhere else. Edison went 1,000 miles away from home, and by the age of 15, he had 5 separate prosperous businesses underway, all on his own, without any money in his pocket when he landed in Michigan. Carnegie begged his parents, they were Scottish immigrants and they worked in a factory, not to force him to go to school. He was 7 years old, and by the age of 12, he was a partner of the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Rockefeller had a similar experience. Our Nobel Prize-winning authors, William Faulkner, got a D in English and in disgust dropped out and, of course, won the Nobel Prize. Hemingway didn't bother. He drove an ambulance in the First World War as a volunteer, and he won a Nobel Prize.
So let me stop you for a second, John. What's the difference between Thomas Edison and Andrew Carnegie and William Faulkner and all those other dropouts who really don't prosper?
Well, most of the dropouts who don't prosper have quit on themselves. They believe what they're told. They're told they're dyslexic, even though the closer you come to examine that peculiar medical condition, the more difficult it comes to believe that we're not dealing with some medically created piece of science fiction. I will give you a dyslexic that all of you in Texas know about. You may not know he's dyslexic. A Danish kid named Ingvar Kamprad was diagnosed as hopelessly dyslexic, dropped out of school, and became a bicycle salesman for matches. I mean, it sounds like something out of a fairy tale. Matches, fish, and Christmas tree ornaments. That guy today not only has $42 billion, but his IKEA stores are all over the world, including, I believe, in Dallas. Is that not so?
It's in Frisco, but yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sure. The numbers of these people are so large that we would be hard-pressed to deal with them if we held public discussions or debates, because the explanation that these are one-of-a-kind people begins to pale from the profusion of these names that exist. Seymour Papert, who certainly all the parents listening understand. He was the head of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab, and he wrote a book called Mindstorms in 1990. And he said, I'm quoting directly from the book, and this is what I found to be true as a teacher, all learning can be learned as the child learns to talk painlessly, successfully, and without organized instruction. Now, that's not coming from a wild-eyed radical. It's coming from an MIT professor with an international reputation. Walter Lippmann, who maybe the younger people wouldn't know, but this was as big a name in American journalism and political philosophy as we have had in the 20th century. Lippmann spoke before the Association for the Advancement of Science in 1940, and let me quote exactly what he said. He said, the prevailing education is destined to destroy Western civilization and is, in fact, destroying it. Now, what he meant by that wasn't some wild-eyed radical screed. He meant that the incursion of the Prussian-German system, which was aimed at turning young men and young women, boys and girls, into human resources, was ruining the inventiveness, the ingenuity, the principles and values that had set Western civilization apart from the other great civilizations in world history. That here are two very unradical human beings, and they're saying things even more radical than you've heard me say this morning.
So in the few seconds that we have left, if you had, John, a child of preschool age today and you had to work full-time to support that child and couldn't homeschool, what sort of choice would you make in terms of education?
Well, first of all, I would take a heavy role in the kid's education. I would make sure that the kid understood how to see the school around him or her as an anthropologist would see a strange tribe. I would discuss what seemed to be going on. I would challenge, but politely and quietly, all the textbook contentions, because they're the result of committees, each one of which has the right to weed out certain objectionable statements. I would make sure that by the age of 12, that everything that passes for college education would have passed before my kids' experience. I would make sure they had.
John, I'm so sorry that we're out of time now. The book is Weapons of Mass Instruction. Really interesting stuff to think about. Thank you so much, John.
Oh, this has been a great pleasure. Go to my website and you can read my last book for free on it. It's produced by www.johntaylorgatter.com. Please do. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
And order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.